Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and we're all in this together. April 15th is just around the corner, and unless you're one of those incredibly organized, on-time, and on-task people, you might be struggling to get that return done, like the rest of us. But no time like the present to get working on turning 2015 into an incredible year. We can start by incorporating new thinking into the mix. Today's show gets down to business with books from creative thinkers who innovate in the corporate world and in government. My guest today is Congressman Barney Frank. During his stellar Capitol Hill career, Mr. Frank consistently legislated for fairness, financial reform, and social change. There's so much to enjoy in his wonderfully vibrant memoir, so let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. Entrepreneur and journalist Shane Snow, who writes for Wired, Fast Company, and The New Yorker, analyzes the lives of people and companies that do incredible things in an implausibly short time. Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success, explores how some startups go from zero to billions in mere months. How, for example, Alexander the Great and Tonight Show host Jimmy Fallon climbed quickly to the top. What is it that high-growth businesses, world-class heart surgeons, and underdog marketers do in common to beat the norm? One way or another, they do it like computer hackers. They employ what psychologists call lateral thinking, rethinking convention and breaking rules that aren't rules. These are not shortcuts, which produce often dubious short-term gains, but ethical smart cuts that eliminate unnecessary effort and yield sustainable momentum. Smart Cuts shatters common wisdom about success and shows how innovators and icons do the incredible by working smarter. The author shares the narration with Eric Bergman.
According to video game lore, these warp pipes were created so game testers could evaluate later levels without having to beat early worlds over and over again. Some, however, suspect that these secret pipes were left as Easter eggs for fans to discover. Nate didn't care about why the warp pipes were there. He just sent his Mario straight to them. He raced through level 1-1, then broke a hole in the ceiling on level 1-2 and ran full speed on top of the level until he found the secret chamber with warp pipes to worlds 2, 3, and 4. Of course, Nate picked world 4. Nate's Mario kept running, pausing only to eat a power-up mushroom so he could race past a pair of Hammer Brothers and survive. This gambit got him through the bad guys in half the time. Soon, he was climbing a secret vine that led to the warp pipe for World 8, which he then had to beat manually. He beat it. By this point, I'd scurried off to Econ, but I can only imagine the victory dance that ensued in our dingy apartment. After I came home and saw the tape, I promptly told everyone I knew. Finishing Super Mario Bros. In 6 minutes using warp pipes isn't possible if you aren't truly good at Super Mario Bros. The warp doesn't mean you're going to win or that you deserve to. It just means that you don't have to slog through stages that you already know you can beat. This is not a book about video games, or the ensuing drama after Nate's record was sought and overtaken over the next few years. This is a book about warp pipes in real life. It took the oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller 46 years to make $1 billion. He clawed his way to the top of the 19th century business world. Starting with a single oil refinery in 1863, over two decades he constructed oil pipelines and bought out rival refineries until he'd built an empire. 70 years later, the 1980s computer baron Michael Dell achieved billionaire status in 14 years, Bill Gates in 12. In the 1990s, Jerry Yang and David Filo of Yahoo each earned 10 figures in just 4 years. It took Pierre Omidyar, founder of eBay, 3 years to do it. And in the late 2000s, Groupon's Andrew Mason did it in 2. Sure, there's been inflation since Rockefeller, but there's no disputing that we've decreased the time it takes innovative people to achieve dreams, get rich, and make an impact on the world. And this has largely been due to technology and communication. A serious assessment of the history of technology shows that technological change is exponential, writes the futurist and author Ray Kurzweil, in his famous essay, The Law of Accelerating Returns. So we won't experience 100 years of progress in the 21st century. It will be more like 20,000 years of progress at today's rate. Here we come, Star Trek. At the same time, many industries remain decidedly stuck in the past. Most large businesses stop growing after a few years. Formal education in many cases is so slow or out of date that venture capitalists pay bright people to skip school and start internet companies. Conventional wisdom outside of the technology industry on innovation and career building has hardly evolved since the 19th century. We're multiplying our capabilities as a civilization, and yet we still accept the notion that important societal progress, like combating inequality and crime, or even innovating in government and medicine, must take generations. Despite leaps in what we can do, most of us still follow comfortable, pre-prescribed paths. We work hard, but hardly question whether we're working smart. On the other hand, some among us manage to build eBay in the time it takes the rest of us to build a house. Pick your era in history and you'll find a handful of people across industries and continents who buck the norm and do incredible things in implausibly short amounts of time. The common pattern is that, like computer hackers, certain innovators break convention to find better routes to stunning accomplishments. The question is, can finding these better routes be taught?
We've just heard Smart Cuts by Shane Snow. As a technology pioneer at MIT and as the leader of three successful startups, Kevin Ashton experienced firsthand the all-consuming challenge of creating something new. Now, in How to Fly a Horse, Ashton leads us on a journey through humanity's greatest creations to uncover the surprising truth behind who creates and how they do it. From the lab where the secrets of DNA were first revealed by a long-forgotten woman, to the electromagnetic chamber where the stealth bomber was born on a 25-cent bet, to the Ohio bicycle shop where the Wright brothers set out to fly a horse, Ashton showcases seemingly unremarkable individuals, their gradual steps, multiple failures, and countless ordinary and usually uncredited acts that lead to our most astounding breakthroughs. Ashton, who narrates, examines why innovators meet resistance and how they overcome it, why most organizations stifle creative people, and how the most creative organizations work.
There is a myth about how something new comes to be. Geniuses have dramatic moments of insight, where great things and thoughts are born whole. Poems are written in dreams. Symphonies are composed complete. Science is accomplished with eureka shrieks. Businesses are built by magic touch. Something is not, then is. We do not see the road from nothing to new, and maybe we do not want to. Artistry must be misty magic, not sweat and grind. It dulls the luster to think that every elegant equation, beautiful painting, and brilliant machine is born of effort and error, the progeny of false starts and failures, and that each maker is as flawed, small, and mortal as the rest of us. It is seductive to conclude that great innovation is delivered to us by miracle via genius. And so, the myth. The myth has shaped how we think about creating for as long as creating has been thought about. In ancient civilizations, people believed that things could be discovered but not created. For them, everything had already been created. They shared the perspective of Carl Sagan's joke on this topic. If you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. In the Middle Ages, creation was possible, but was reserved for divinity and those with divine inspiration. In the Renaissance, humans were finally thought capable of creation, but they had to be great men. Leonardo, Michelangelo, Botticelli, and the like. As the 19th century turned into the 20th, creating became a subject for philosophical, then psychological investigation. The question being investigated was, how do the great men do it? And the answer had the residue of medieval divine intervention. A lot of the meat of the myth was added at this time, with the same few anecdotes about epiphanies and genius, including hoaxes like Mozart's letter, being circulated and recirculated. In 1926, Alfred North Whitehead made a noun from a verb and gave the myth its name. Creativity. The creativity myth implies that few people can be creative, that any successful creator will experience dramatic flashes of insight, and that creating is more like magic than work. A rare few have what it takes, and for them it comes easy. Anybody else's creative efforts are doomed. How to fly a horse is about why the myth is wrong. I believed the myth until 1999. My early career at London University's student newspaper, at a Bloomsbury noodle startup called Wagamama, and at a soap and paper company called Procter & Gamble, suggested that I was not good at creating. I struggled to execute my ideas. When I tried, people got angry. When I succeeded, they forgot that the idea was mine. I read every book I could find about creation, and each one said the same thing. Ideas come magically, people greet them warmly, and creators are winners. My ideas came gradually. People greeted them with heat instead of warmth, and I felt like a loser. My performance reviews were bad. I was always in danger of being fired. I could not understand why my creative experiences were not like the ones in the books. It first occurred to me that the books might be wrong in 1997, when I was trying to solve an apparently boring problem that turned out to be interesting. I could not keep a popular shade of Procter & Gamble lipstick on store shelves. Half of all stores were out of stock at any given time. After much research, I discovered that the cause of the problem was insufficient information. The only way to see what was on a shelf at any moment was to go look. This was a fundamental limit of 20th century information technology. Almost all the data entered into computers in the 1900s came from people typing on keyboards or sometimes scanning barcodes. Store workers did not have time to stare at shelves all day, then enter data about what they saw, so every store's computer system was blind.
That was How to Fly a Horse by Kevin Ashton. Barnett Barney Frank represented the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts for more than 3 decades. He chaired the House Financial Services Committee from 2007 to 2011 and was a leading co-sponsor of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, a sweeping reform of the U.S. financial industry. Barney was born in Bayonne, New Jersey in 1940. His dad owned a truck stop. Barney graduated from Harvard College and Harvard Law. He worked as a political aide to Boston's Mayor Kevin White before winning election to the Massachusetts House of Representatives in 1972. In 1980, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. In 1987, he became the first member of Congress to voluntarily come out. And in 2012, he married his longtime partner, James Reddy, becoming the first member of Congress to marry someone of the same sex while in office. Frank did not seek re-election in 2012 and retired from Congress at the end of his term in January 2013. Today we'll speak with the congressman about his new autobiography, Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to the Same-Sex Marriage. Welcome, Mr. Frank. It's an honor to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
In the first few pages of the book, you write about your desire to pursue a public life, but you say, "I was a Jewish homosexual. While I had planned to keep my sexual orientation a secret, it was too late to conceal my Jewishness. I had already outed myself with a bar mitzvah." So how was that bar mitzvah?
Well, it was very nice. There's a picture of it in the book. I'm leaning over, blowing out the candles, flanked by my parents, my bubby, and aunts and uncles. And, you know, I put that in deliberately because when I was growing up in the 50s, anti-Semitism was still a serious career problem for those of us who were Jewish. And, you know, we have issues that we don't get resolved in this country or we don't do them quickly enough. But I think we can say that we have made a very great deal of progress in doing away with anti-Semitism. And a young Jewish boy or girl today thinking about politics really does not have to be deterred the way I thought I would have to be 60 years ago.
You know, I was surprised to read that you have been the only Jewish congressman to represent Massachusetts since 1888.
Yes, but we have had other Jews have been elected since, actually only recently. Massachusetts has been a little bit of a laggard there. You know, there have been Jewish members of Congress from all over, including Texas and Kansas, and there's currently one from Tennessee. For some reason, it just didn't work out in Massachusetts.
Yeah. You described the book as a personal history of two seismic shifts in American life, the sharp drop in prejudice against LGBT people and the equally sharp increase in anti-government opinion. We rejoice in the progress, but do you truly believe we can do anything about anti-government prejudice?
Yes, we can, because there are people who are philosophically opposed to government. I honor that viewpoint. I disagree with it. We're not going to turn them around. People who've read Ayn Rand or have this deeply conservative view who think you just have to let nature take its course, they're not our voters. But there are people in America, many of the kind of working class people, people who honor the memory of Franklin Roosevelt, who supported Harry Truman and John Kennedy. They, I think, it's an interesting paradox. These are people who do believe that government can be very helpful, but they are disappointed that it hasn't been. We've seen since the 70s a shift in the nature of the economy, both in America and in the world, that's been disadvantageous to people who don't have college degrees and a high degree of particular skills in technology or elsewhere. And as the country has gotten wealthier, they have not participated. People who used to be able to make good money with an auto plant or a steel plant, those jobs have left. And they are angry because they do not understand why the government hasn't helped them. And I agree with that. The problem is that their anger that the government hasn't helped them leads them to blame sort of government almost, not almost. And so then, paradoxically, they vote for people who are going to make it worse. And so, yeah, I think we can break that cycle. I believe if we could expand certain government programs, make it easier for people who aren't wealthy to go to college without amassing huge debts, reduce the medical care costs that people have to pay out of their own pocket, provide better jobs in the public sector, expand construction jobs, that in fact, many of these people would say, yeah, this is government at its best. And so what I propose is two ways that we find that money. One, I think we wildly overspend on the military. You know, if we hadn't gone into the Iraq War, we'd have $1 trillion now that we could have been spending on things that would be very useful. And I think the society makes a great mistake by locking up people because they smoke marijuana. And even heroin and cocaine costing an enormous amount of money. If we could free that money up, we could make government much more meaningful for the average citizen.
You share your struggle over the years with your decision to come out. Why the year 1987?
Well, it goes like this. In the late 70s, I first decided to come out. When I got elected to office just after the Stonewall riots. So this was the beginning of the gay rights movement. And it was not, it wouldn't have been possible for me to get elected, but I did make a decision back then, 1972, though I couldn't be honest about who I was not going to be hypocritical about whether or not it was a good thing. So I became early on one of the leading, frankly, one of the first people in America to introduce what we then called gay rights bills in the Massachusetts legislature for me. And as the 70s went on, I said, you know, this is a little strange. Here I am fighting for the right of gay people to have full lives, but I'm denying myself what I'm fighting for everybody else to have. So in the late 70s, I decided, okay, it's time to just tell people who I am. If that costs me a political seat, that's not worth denying my life. And I was about to do that. I'd just begun to do that with friends and family when I got the opportunity to run for Congress. Well, I would never have been elected to Congress. I was out. I thought that was a great chance to do more of what I cared about in terms of improving the quality of life in society, making things fairer. So I kind of put that on hold in 1980. I then began to think, okay, I'll go to Washington, and maybe it's possible in Washington to have a private life as a gay man, meeting other people, enjoying other people's company, but not being out publicly. And I found out pretty soon that didn't work. If you are a prominent person, as I was becoming, you simply can't have a satisfying private life because you're so busy trying to protect yourself and conceal that life. So by the early 80s, I decided I would come out. Then there was a little detour. A good friend of mine, another gay man who was a closeted congressman, got involved in a difficult situation, having a romantic relationship with one of the House pages. He was old enough, it wasn't an illegal thing, but it was a problem for people. He was then censured for this, and he had to fight hard for re-election. Well, he had a tough re-election in 1984. If I had come out at the same time, it would have been used to undercut him. They would have said, well, here's one gay guy that didn't get in trouble, here's one who did, let's vote for the other one. So I postponed it a couple of years. So finally I decided after... That I was going to come out. I didn't want to come out in the same year as the election. I wanted to give people a chance to get used to it. So 87 became the year.
And were you surprised by the reaction of your constituents and the country?
Pleasantly surprised. I thought I would survive it, but I was actually many of the most liberal members of Congress who were themselves supportive of LGBT rights asked me, the straight ones, "Don't, please don't come out because, you know, you're a great ally of ours on a lot of these other issues. And if people know that you're gay, they'll just only care about your opinions on those issues. You'll get kind of marginalized and stereotyped." And I couldn't tell them that that wasn't going to happen. I just couldn't continue to live in this self-repressed way. And it turned out we were all too pessimistic.
We're speaking with Barney Frank on The Book Report. And are you surprised at how quickly it seems to us now that the states are writing gay marriage into law?
I'm totally surprised. I was hopeful that things would get better. But, you know, this is a movement that started in 1972. I talk about anti-Semitism and how we have gotten, I think, anti-Semitism down to a negligible factor. But that's a fight that started in the 40s. The LGBT fight started decades later, and it is on the verge of a very big victory. I think what happened was this. We were the victims of prejudice because we were hiding. And it's kind of hard to fight back when you're in hiding. And that particularly allowed other people, the people who were bigoted, to paint the picture of us. We hid our reality, so the mistaken image carried. And then beginning really in the 72, late 60s, early 70s, we started being honest about who we were, more and more people. And I think that broke the back of it. Our opponents made all these dire predictions about what would happen if we were treated fairly. None of them came true. And as a result, that the whole thing just moved much more quickly. I guess, you know, 15 years ago, if you'd asked me, well, now you're a gay man, you're out, but why don't you get married while you're in Congress? My view would have been, well, that's going to be so controversial that it would get in the way of my being able to do other things. Within a few years, 2012, when Jim and I did get married while I was still in Congress, there was still some controversy, but the controversy was among some of my colleagues who were angry that I didn't invite them.
I wanted to ask you, should there be consequences for the 47 Republican congressmen who signed the letter to the Iranian leaders?
Absolutely. First of all, you know, they ought to get most of them who have been around for a while severely wrapped for their hypocrisy and inconsistency. You know, during Ronald Reagan and both Presidents Bush, the general Republican view was, oh, we have to have a strong executive. There's a great deal of hypocrisy for some of these Republican senators. I'm sure you'll go back and find situations where they said, oh, you must take the president's lead on foreign policy. Differing with the foreign policy is, of course, perfectly reasonable. But writing a letter to another country saying, please don't pay any attention to what our president says. We plan at some point to break whatever word he gives you, as he is now legally entitled to do, that's outrageous. And yes, I would hope, frankly, that this would, you know, obviously I have a partisan interest as well, but I hope this would be one more piece of evidence for people that it does not make sense to put people in charge of government who don't like government, who have a purely destructive view, and it doesn't make sense to put people in power who are so eager to be negative that they disregard any of the normal rules about how to run things. So this ought to be a negative, not just for the Republican senators who signed this. It was, after all, almost all of them. And remember, everything we're told is that the Republican senators are the reasonable ones compared to the Republican House members. I think this was something that should be dealt with at the polls, and I think people ought to reject it.
Yes. I learned in the book in your first race for the U.S. Congress against Richard Jones, your team struggled with the issue of negative campaigning. Do you think 2016 will show a preponderance of negative campaigning in the presidential election?
Sadly, yes, for a couple of reasons. First of all, right now, the public's in a bad mood. And they're in a bad mood, I think, in part because of what I said earlier, that the economy has turned against working people, and there are things that we should be doing to undo that. But also, look, this negative campaigning started in 95 with Newt Gingrich, and it has worked. And, you know, part of it is the responses with the voters. People tell you they don't like negative campaigning. Why all this negativism? But unfortunately, all the evidence we have is that they respond to it.
As our show is originating in South Florida, and Jeb Bush was our governor, how do you feel about him as our next president?
Well, he's a reasonable man, but I disagree. I think he is one too conservative in the first place. I'll tell you, my first real interaction with him was a Florida issue. That's when he just, I think, behaved very unreasonably in trying to get the courts overturned and have the Congress cancel the decision by Terri Schiavo's husband to stop the feeding in accordance with her wishes. Bush was just a fanatic then. The notion, you know, for somebody supposed to be conservative and believe in restraints on government, insisting that the politicians will decide when life ends and when the family makes that decision, that was a zeal that was very, very disappointing to me. And then just in general, you know, I think the policies that the Republican Party has followed of cutting back substantially on domestic programs and overspending in military activity is a terrible mistake, and Jeb Bush is a part of that. I really believe that America's making a big mistake by letting the rest of the world put all their burdens on us. You know, I just noticed that England is cutting its military spending. Well, if the world is somewhat dangerous in Europe, why is England cutting its spending? Because they can count on America to bail them out. And I want to make the case that we should be protecting ourselves and be ready to help others. But I think the time has come for us to stop carrying quite as much of the financial burden as we carry worldwide.
Well, Congressman, I want to congratulate you on the rave reviews the book is getting and let readers know it's a really fabulous read. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sample of Frank, narrated by the congressman.
Over the objections of private industry, many public health advocates, especially those focused on children, pressed for action. They were successful. The process began in 1970 with the Clean Air Act, which was followed by the Lead-Based Poisoning Prevention Act a year later. A series of amendments and implementing regulations steadily increased the restrictions, culminating in 1978 with a ban on lead in paint and a statute enacted in 1990 and effective in 1995 prohibiting lead in gasoline. Critics of government regulation should heed all of this carefully. As the prohibitions came into effect, the incidence of death and illness from lead ingestion dropped drastically. Between 1975 and 1980 and 2007 and 2008, lead levels in children's blood dropped 90%. In 1990, the FDA estimated that there were already 70,000 fewer children with IQs below 70 because of these rules. The paint and gasoline industries denied that lead was harmful in the amounts present in their products and predicted severe economic harm if they had to remove it. They were never able to explain why banning lead in fact coincided not just with fewer brain-damaged children, but also with their own continued prosperity. Lead-damaged brains still exist, sadly, and there is more to be done to reduce the number. But the undeniable fact is that millions of Americans have healthy brains today, in large part because, contrary to the old joke, some people from the government did come to help them. In 1954, the government was still popular, but homosexuals were held in universal contempt. This had been made explicit the previous year when President Eisenhower issued an executive order decreeing that people like me could never receive security clearances. We were too inherently untrustworthy to help protect our country from its enemies. I do not remember being specifically aware of the order at the time. But as an avid newspaper reader growing up in Bayonne, New Jersey, I must have seen the New York Times headline that referred to us as, quote, perverts, unquote. And I was fully aware of what awaited me if my true nature was known. Parentheses, I say true nature for the edification of that dwindling set of bigots who justify mistreating us because we, quote, chose an alternative lifestyle, unquote. Being hated is really an experience sought by teenagers. At 14, I decided I would keep my sexual identity a secret forever, although I didn't give much thought to how that was going to work. Terrified by the obloquy that would come with being found out, I regarded total concealment as my only option. The recognition that there could be no role for queer in public life had an additional and deep emotional impact. It is very probably the reason that I later approached every tough election campaign with the assumption I would lose. A televised Senate hearing first inspired my fascination with government. My father was what we now call an early adopter. When I was born in 1940, he celebrated by buying a television set, before almost everybody else and before there was much to watch. I have early memories of Western movies, the second Billy Conn Joe Louis fight, Howdy Doody, and Senator Estes Kefauver's investigation into organized crime. I enjoyed all the programs, but I never wanted to be a cowboy, a boxer, or a puppeteer. I preferred the idea of sitting behind an impressive dais grilling colorful mafiosi. At 10, I was more intrigued than instructed. But when another set of hearings came on the TV 4 years later, I was hooked by both the spectacle and the subject matter. This was the Army-McCarthy brawl. In 1954, Senator Joseph McCarthy turned his demagogic attention to the U.S. Army. The Army had just finished fighting two communist regimes in Korea, but this did not stop McCarthy from deeming it soft on communism. The Army hired the Boston lawyer Joseph Welch as its lead counsel in the Senate hearings that were held on McCarthy's accusations. Welch became a hero to Americans in general and liberals in particular for the deftness of his anti-McCarthy thrusts. One of the deftest was his sly allusion to the sexual orientation of McCarthy's chief aide, Roy Cohn. A closeted gay man, Cohn would angrily denounce any attempt to out him until the day he died of AIDS-related illnesses decades later. In questioning one of McCarthy's assistants, Welch asked him if he was contending that a certain photograph had come from, quote, a pixie, unquote. Unwisely trying to turn Welch's sarcasm against him, McCarthy intervened and asked Welch to define pixie. Welch pounced. A pixie, he gleefully explained, is a close relative of a fairy.
That was Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage by Barney Frank. From acclaimed historian Richard Norton Smith comes the definitive life of an American millionaire and statesman, Nelson Rockefeller, one of the most complex and compelling figures of the 20th century. Grandson of oil magnate John D. Rockefeller, Nelson coveted the White House from childhood. Quote, "When you think of what I had," he once remarked, "what else was there to aspire to?" Before he was 30, he had helped his father develop Rockefeller Center and his mother establish the Museum of Modern Art. At 32, he was Franklin Roosevelt's wartime coordinator for Latin America. As New York's four-term governor, he set national standards in education, the environment, and urban policy. The charismatic face of liberal republicanism, Rockefeller championed civil rights and health insurance for all. 3 times he sought the presidency, arguably in the wrong party. At the Republican National Convention in San Francisco in 1964, locked in an epic battle with Barry Goldwater, Rockefeller denounced extremist elements in the GOP, a moment that changed the party forever. But in the end, he had to settle for 2 dispiriting years as vice president under Gerald Ford. In On His Own Terms, Richard Norton Smith recreates Rockefeller's improbable rise to the governor's mansion, his politically disastrous divorce and remarriage, and his often surprising relationships with presidents and political leaders. From the deadly 1971 prison uprising at Attica and unceasing battles with New York City Mayor John Lindsay to his son's unsolved disappearance and the much gossiped about circumstances of his death, Nelson Rockefeller had a life of astonishing color, range, and relevance. Paul Michael performs the book.
Vent, Rockefeller replies tartly, "That's your problem, not mine." As good as his word, On a 1963 European trip, the obligatory grand tour for would-be presidents, Rockefeller left both British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan and the newly crowned Pope Paul VI to cool their heels while he dallied in art galleries. Tonight, however, is different. On this second night of the 1964 Republican Convention, a slot reserved for debate over the party platform, even Rockefeller is a clock watcher. It is a little after 6 o'clock in San Francisco, 9 o'clock in the East. Sidelined by convention managers who hope by delaying his appearance to diminish his national television audience, Rockefeller exhibits the restlessness of a caged animal. It is a familiar stance to those who know him. "He is like a perfect engine," explains his friend, architect Wallace Harrison. "It starts acting up if you don't keep it right in the groove of creating something." As with an engine, some part of Rockefeller is perpetually in motion. Journalists, unable to match his dervish energy, ask whether the governor eats Benzedrine for breakfast. They recall how, at the conclusion of an exhausting campaign, the victorious candidate flew to his 14,000-acre Venezuela ranch. There he relaxed by scaling a 5,000-foot mountain on horseback, a 5-hour round trip, followed by a punishing swim. His approach to politics is just as intense. His wooing of voters has been likened to a fullback crashing the line. Rarefied background notwithstanding, Rockefeller may be the best retail campaigner in America. Upon alighting from his private plane, he crosses the airport tarmac with a loping stride of entitlement, all the while offering mechanics and baggage handlers his signature greeting. "Hiya, fella." This cheery salutation, improvised to conceal his inability to remember names, is delivered in a voice of gravel sanded to a patrician softening of consonants. The same faux intimacy is accorded less successfully to people who have been around him for years. "You don't know my name, do you?" a grizzled New York reporter once demanded of the governor. "Yeah," said Rockefeller. "It's some kind of Polish name, isn't it?" Inside the terminal, Nelson approaches a man cradling a pay telephone to his ear. "Who are you talking to?" he asks the startled stranger. Not waiting for an answer, Rockefeller seizes the phone and introduces himself to the man's wife. To passers-by, he flashes the jack-o'-lantern grin familiar to Oregon lumberjacks, jostling street crowds in Spanish Harlem, French-speaking mill workers in northern New Hampshire, and children of all ages. Rockefeller has discarded the battered fedora, evocative of his lifelong hero Franklin Delano Roosevelt, worn in his early campaigns. But he remains indifferent to clothes, favoring double-breasted suits bought off the rack for $150 and proudly displaying tags from outfits worn 20 years or more. The candidate's baggy pants and scuffed shoes are of a piece with his cast-iron stomach and exuberant fondness for Coney Island hot dogs and onion rolls from a Lower East Side delicatessen. An equal opportunity snacker, Rockefeller devours tacos, cannoli, knishes, mulligatawny soup, described by one associate as a wasp minestrone, salsa, and soul food with the same gusto he exhibits scooping up caviar or dining on whitebait and oyster crabs at the 21 Club. To cab drivers, bartenders, and tabloid readers alike, he is Rocky, the uncommonly wealthy patrician with the common touch. Those who know better avoid the familiar moniker. Those who know best acknowledge their emotional distance. "I only wish we knew him as well as the voters of New York do," Rockefeller's daughter Mary has said of her father. "Gregarious and outgoing," claims William J. Ronan, for 8 years his chief deputy in Albany, and for many more, a close collaborator.
We've just heard On His Own Terms by Richard Norton Smith. Do you sometimes feel overworked and underutilized? Stretched too thin? Busy but not productive? Do you feel like your time is constantly being hijacked by other people's agendas? If you answered yes to any of these, the way out is the way of the essentialist. Greg McEwen's essentialism isn't about getting more done in less time. It's about getting only the right things done. It's a systematic discipline for discerning what is absolutely essential, then eliminating everything that is not, so that we can make the highest possible contribution towards the things that really matter. The disciplined pursuit of less empowers us to reclaim control of our own choices about where to spend our precious time and energy, instead of giving others the implicit permission to choose for us. Essentialism is not one more thing. It's a new way of doing everything, the author narrates.
His newfound commitment to doing only the things that were truly important and eliminating everything else restored the quality of his work. Instead of making just a millimeter of progress in a million directions, he began to generate tremendous momentum towards accomplishing the things that were truly vital. He continued this for several months. He immediately found that he not only got more of his day back at work, in the evenings he got even more time back at home. He said, "I got back my family life. I can go home at a decent time. Now, instead of being a slave to his phone, he shuts it down. He goes to the gym. He goes out to eat with his wife." To his great surprise, there were no negative repercussions to his experiment. His manager didn't chastise him. His colleagues didn't resent him. Quite the opposite, because he was left only with the projects that were meaningful to him and actually valuable to the company. They began to respect and value his work more than ever. His work became fulfilling again. His performance ratings went up, and he ended up with one of the largest bonuses of his entire career. In this example is the basic value proposition of essentialism. Only once you give yourself permission to stop trying to do it all, to stop saying yes to everyone, can you make your highest contribution towards the things that really matter. What about you? How many times have you reacted to a request by saying yes without really thinking about it? How many times have you resented committing to do something and wondered, why did I sign up for this? How often did you say yes simply to please, or to avoid trouble, or because yes had just become your default response? Now let me ask you this. Have you ever found yourself stretched too thin? Have you ever felt both overworked and underutilized? Have you ever found yourself majoring in minor activities? Do you ever feel busy but not productive? Like you're always in motion but never getting anywhere? If you answered yes to any of these, the way out is the way of the essentialist. The way of the essentialist. Dieter Rams was the lead designer at Braun for many years. He is driven by the idea that almost everything is noise. He believes very few things are essential. His job is to filter through that noise until he gets to the essence. For example, as a young 24-year-old at the company, he was asked to collaborate on a record player. The norm at the time was to cover the turntable in a solid wood lid, or even to incorporate the player into a piece of living room furniture. Instead, he and his team removed the clutter and designed a player with a clear plastic cover on the top and nothing more. It was the first time such a design had been used, and it was so revolutionary, people worried it might bankrupt the company because nobody would buy it. It took courage, as it always does, to eliminate the non-essential. By the 60s, this aesthetic started to gain traction. In time, it became the design every other record player followed. Dieter's design criteria can be summarized by a characteristically succinct principle, captured in just three German words, weniger, aber besser. The English translation is less, but better. A more fitting definition of essentialism would be hard to come by. The way of the essentialist is the relentless pursuit of less, but better. It doesn't mean occasionally giving a nod to the principle. It means pursuing it in a disciplined way. The way of the essentialist isn't about setting New Year's resolutions to say no more, or about pruning your inbox, or about mastering some new strategy in time management. It is about pausing constantly to ask, am I investing in the right activities? There are far more activities and opportunities in the world than we have time and resources to invest in. And although many of them may be good or even very good, the fact is that most are trivial and few are vital. The way of the essentialist involves learning to tell the difference, learning to filter through all those options and selecting only those that are truly essential. Essentialism is not about how to get more things done, it's about how to get the right things done.
We've just heard Essentialism by Greg McKeown. Whenever Carl Richards tells people about his job as a financial advisor, the conversation inevitably turns to how hopeless people feel when it comes to dealing with money. People start to beg, just tell me what to do. Even if you have a shelf full of personal finance books, you probably don't have time to make sense of all the information there. You don't just want good advice, you want the best advice. So rather than doing the wrong thing, you do nothing. 401ks and bank statements pile up, unexamined or maybe even unopened. What people don't realize is that bad calls about money aren't failures. They're just what happens when emotional creatures have to make decisions about the future with limited information. Carl counsels to stop striving for perfection and instead commit to a process of guessing and making adjustments when things go off track. In his new title, The One-Page Financial Plan, A Simple Way to Be Smart About Your Money, he shows how, in a single page, you can prioritize what you really want in life and figure out how to get there. That's because a great financial plan has nothing to do with what the markets are doing, what your real estate agent is pitching, or the hot stock your brother-in-law told you about. It has everything to do with what's important to you. Carl, who narrates, goes over details like, how much do I need to invest in a year, and how do I allocate it? How much life insurance do I need? Carl shares common sense strategies that offer clarity about the big picture so you can cope with the unexpected.
It doesn't surprise me that my most successful friends are confused when it comes to savings and retirement. When they do something, they want to do it right. They don't just want good advice, they want the best advice. They've often got a shelf full of books about investing or finance, but they simply don't have time to really dive in. So rather than do the wrong thing, they do nothing. Of course, it's not just fear of making a mistake that holds us back from taking action. It's also the mistakes that we've already made that we don't want to own up to. Often just the idea of having to open up our bank statements can be stressful, so we let them pile up, hoping that something will happen to change our situation. Of course, what actually needs to change is our own behavior, but that's easier said than done. There are many stories these days of people who lost their financial bearings during the housing boom and the crisis that followed. But when I lost my own house in 2010, it was a little bit different. I'm a financial advisor. I get paid to help people make smart financial choices. I should have known that we couldn't afford a house that cost almost twice what we'd originally set out to spend. I should have known that there was something wrong with being able to borrow 100% of the purchase price. I should have listened to my gut when it told me something's wrong. I'm a financial advisor. And yet I never sat down to figure out what it would take to make this work. I just wanted to believe our real estate agent, despite the fact that he was making money on the deal. And it was so easy to believe he had been right, at least at first. We loved our new house. The children went to awesome public schools, and we made some great friends. I could ride my bike to Red Rocks, the wilderness area outside of town, and for a time the real estate market erased any doubt I may have had. It just kept going up until, well, you know. Yes, I'm a financial advisor, but in the heat of the moment, when my income was rising rapidly and home prices were soaring with no sign of stopping, I wasn't thinking like one. Some might say I wasn't even thinking at all. I was just following the crowd. After I watched my house almost triple in value and used some of that equity to start a business,
the real estate market collapsed faster than almost any of us realized. Within a matter of just a few short months, we found ourselves faced with the reality that we had to move back to Utah, and that we owed more than the house was worth. After working with the bank for almost a year, everyone agreed that a short sale was the best option. As devastating as that experience was, I learned something valuable. The best financial plan has nothing to do with what the markets are doing, nothing to do with what your real estate agent is telling you, nothing to do with the hot stock your brother-in-law told you about. It has everything to do with what's most important to you. Over the last two decades, I've had thousands of conversations about this topic. I've worked with hundreds of clients to create customized financial plans and talked to hundreds of advisors about their best ideas and techniques. And as you'll hear about throughout this book, I've learned from experience. I've made mistakes that no rational financial advisor should make. But of course, I'm not just a financial advisor. I'm also human. And a big part of being human involves irrationality. Irrational decisions and bad calls about money aren't failures. They're just what happens when emotional creatures have to make decisions about the future with limited information. They're not something to run from. They're something to be acknowledged, something we can learn from, and yes, even something we can plan for. With that in mind, we're going to scrap any striving for perfection and instead commit to a process of guessing and making adjustments when things go off track. Of course, we're going to make the best guesses we can, but we're not going to obsess over getting them exactly right.
We've just heard The One-Page Financial Plan by Carl Richards. Business and cultural visionary Seth Godin's goal is to transform the terrain of marketing and commerce. But he's found that most of us remain stuck in our work lives. What's keeping us back? The problem isn't a lack of knowledge. The problem is fear. His Leap First is an innovative audio program that invites us to learn with him, personally, unrehearsed and in the moment, as he explores overcoming instinctual resistance to risk and change, discovering our creative genius in the face of the empty page, finding the courage to share that work with vulnerability, generosity, and results. Recorded in an intimate gathering of aspiring entrepreneurs, writers, and leaders, Leap First teaches us 49 essential principles and life lessons that will be a catalyst intended to trigger our own passion and insight.
One of the things that we have to understand is that money follows rules of physics. One of the rules it follows is debt grows and savings grow slower. So if you go $1 in debt every week, after a few years, you will be insanely in debt. And if you add $1 a week to your savings, after a few years, you'll have some savings. If you're on the debt side of that equation, it's almost impossible to get out because we're going to charge you 18% or 30% interest. And it compounds and it gets worse, which amplifies the story we are already telling ourselves about money. The history of money is interesting. It used to be we traded this for that. There was no such thing as money. I'll give you my loaf of bread and you will give me some wheat or a fish. Trading, trading, trading. Those trades bring us closer together. Exchange, one-on-one, brings us closer together. Money drives us apart. Money is this third thing that transfers value away from our community to the central bank, away from our community to magical digits and bits. When we pay somebody for something, we're done. Fair and square, even Steven. That's why we're not friends with our banker. It's why if we go to a restaurant and they charge us $12 and we pay $12, nobody owes anybody. But what we learned from Lewis Hyde in his brilliant book, The Gift, there's an alternative, which is that when we give somebody something, that form of exchange brings us closer. Then when our sister calls us up and says, can you loan me $100? We don't say, you're going to have to pay me 5% interest, because interest drives us apart. You don't charge your family interest. That interest is turning it into a financial exchange, which changes the story of the interaction that we're having. So one of the things that we struggle with, if we're someone who is creating something, who's shipping something, who is making art, is we're busy telling ourselves stories about money. Here's one story. One story about money is, my art isn't worth anything if I don't get paid for it. Another story is, if I get paid a lot for my art, it's good. These two stories came out of nowhere. The fact is that most of our lives, certainly before we're 18, we do all sorts of things for free because we love it. And then suddenly we say, now it's time to do work. And when we get paid for something, we now don't like doing it anymore because it's our job. And I think we have to spend some time wrestling with this idea of why will we spend, interesting word, spend, why will we spend our time doing something just because we got paid? Why don't we consider spending our time doing something we love, even if we don't get paid? Is it okay to make art, to ship art, to make a difference, even if we don't get paid in money? Because maybe we get paid in community. Maybe we get paid in the psychic benefit of making a difference. It's only very recently that someone like a musician came to expect that they would get paid for making music. For thousands of years, you didn't get paid for making music. You made music because you wanted to. You made music because you could. And if we can divorce these two things, this idea of feeding our network and feeding our community by making change, by making art, and not even needing to take credit, never mind take money, separate that from, can I create value and do something worth getting paid for that doesn't have to be my art?
That was Leap First by Seth Godin. The old proverb goes, in this world of change, not which comes stays, and not which goes is lost. I hope today's book selection has served up some ideas to start you thinking about making small changes that will have positive impact as the year rolls by. Keep checking my website, bookreportradio.com, for new thought-provoking titles in your favorite genres. Thanks so much for joining me today. And in a week, when thoughts can move away from the IRS and back to the pleasures of life, let's meet again for the next edition of The Book Report.